Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And as a matter of fact, what we're going to kind of cover today, folks, kind of this is putting it all together. We're going to talk about, you know, why counties matter most, which is kind of in line with the article that I've got coming out. And we've got Paul back. Thank you so much for joining. Even though this isn't really content, actually, it was 2 years ago, 2 years and a month ago, if I remember correctly, it was practically to the day, 2 years and a month. It was on a Sunday, though, or no, it was a Saturday. I presented to the Missouri Constitution Party, you know, how to organize your counties and grow them on the Constitution, right?
I remember that.
Yep. And so, and for the most part, it was pretty well received, except there was, you know, one dissenter, but, you know, that's an outlier. And that's, there wasn't a real good academic refuting of this. So what, and it caused me to actually create this article because as I had written, what is the real problem? Martial law in the 21st century and then the unseen teeth in the Constitution. It seemed like the logical article for me to do would have been the First Amendment right of petition, which is what I started doing. And then it just dawned on me that, you know, there really needs to be a substantial academic argument provided why this has to be at the county. And the reason that this was the overwhelming question that needed to be answered, even though it didn't seem like a lot of people were asking the question, I knew eventually it'd be, well, why are we doing this at the county? Because I presented the concept that we focus all of our petitions down at the county level.
Right.
And the reason why, folks, is because this government that we have, as we talked about this with Madison's notes on nullification yesterday, that this hybrid constitutional republic, we actually have two national systems. We have a limited national system where the federal government interfaces with us with all foreign nations. And that's its service to us. That's all it can do. And its requirements are to maintain what is in the best interest for us states when they've actually gone awry, and they've gone awry since the 1800s, in serving other interests at, you know, at our demise. And overall, as things have progressed, our demise becomes more and more prevalent and more pending. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so when we really look at the states and how the states have failed to keep the federal government into check, and we look at the states and go, well, the states are just as bad. I mean, they've become completely corrupted. Mm-hmm. And under our very nose, the federal court system, because I knew this long before I started writing the first, you know, the right of the First Amendment and its importance. I knew the Baker v. Carr, Reynolds v. Sims cases, those two cases. And by the way, you and I need to have a phone call or a conversation with Keith Broders, because I've talked to him and he wants to get involved in petitions and so forth.
And but we do, because he's called me recently and there are a couple of things that he brought up to challenge something that you talked about. So we do need to get to it.
Okay, that's great, because I love it. I love Keith, you know, because he comes up with these challenges, and nine times out of ten, it's just you back up and you go, okay, well, this is why, or what have you. But nevertheless, yeah. I mean, because I've yet to come up with a challenge that doesn't make sense, or, you know, why this isn't the right way to do this. But nevertheless, when we look at the whole point of republic review and the premise of the Constitution, or I should say the nature of constitutions, and, you know, compacts and contract law, the parties to the compact have the authority to hold the entity created in that compact accountable.
And isn't that true in any kind of contractual representation?
Absolutely. That's the nature of contracts, constitutions, contract law. It is a fundamental tenet that the parties to the compact have the ultimate say on whether that compact is being violated or not. And so when, and this is why I point out, and I go through the academics in this article as to how every state was formed after the original 13. And how, even though the 13 states didn't reform themselves, they really should have. And we, the people, should have, in those states, should have said, you know what, we need to institute our county governments first. That's what they should have really done. And because, bottom line, that declaration in the Declaration of Independence that governments are instituted by men.
Men.
Right, but today we look at that as we the people. Governments are instituted by we the people. Those states were actually instituted by whom?
By the people.
No.
You know, no.
No, the original 13 states.
By the counties.
Absolutely not. The original 13 states were instituted by
the monarch.
The monarch through a charter.
Right.
And in the Revolution of Independence, they just declared themselves independent, but they didn't structure themselves to protect themselves from these cabals that actually took over, which is why, and you heard me tell you this throughout the ratification debates, that many of the bigger states were corrupted. They had these cabals of power, and they were the states that didn't want to surrender more power or any more power to this Constitution. That's why they were doing everything they could to kill it.
Wow.
And so that should have been a wake-up call at that point in time to the people saying, you know what? We have a problem at the state level, and we got to reel this all in. And now that we have this beautiful thing called the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, every state constitution must actually have, this has got to be their language, you know, that the U.S. Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and that the powers delegated to this state government, the state government of, and your name, that all powers not delegated to this state government and or restricted to the counties are reserved for the counties and the people, respectively. In other words, every state constitution should have had that ingrained in it so that the state government realized that their dignity, their sovereignty came from the people and the counties.
Correct.
You see my point now?
Oh, yeah, I do.
Yeah, but see, the real problem was that everybody was looking at how wondrous this Constitution was, but nobody really looked at how it basically could shine the light on the fundamental problems existing within the states themselves. Because had they imbued those same principles at the state level, then these states, these original 13 states, wouldn't be in the shape that they're in today.
Sure.
Right. And so when we look at all new states coming into the Union, and so this article, I actually dive into this, and you haven't seen this yet, Paul, but what I do is I provide the Vermont Enabling Act, which is like one paragraph. And in this Enabling Act, it basically says that Vermont is coming into the Union with equal footing. And it identifies that, you know, that the counties are to create the state government and the Constitution.
It says that specifically.
I don't know if it says that specifically, but that's how it happened. And so it got more and more specific down the road. Because Vermont, as it was an extension of New England, Vermont, or actually New England, New Hampshire, because it was a territory, it was already organized by counties. And so the same thing with Kentucky and Tennessee, the next two states that joined the Union. As a matter of fact, Tennessee was an extension of North Carolina, and Kentucky was an extension of Virginia.
Virginia.
And what ended up happening, because all of a sudden people kind of woke up and go, hey, you know, this new constitution doesn't recognize the sovereignty at the same level of the king and the states or the colonies that the king created. Because when the king created these colonies, he created a linear extension of each of these states. You know what I'm talking about?
No.
Where Virginia would actually be a swath, a straight line that would strike from the East Coast all the way over to the Pacific. That there would be this parallel line that would be the kind of the width of Virginia going across the continental United States. And underneath that was North Carolina that would be a strip that would go all the way across to the Pacific. And there's actually a map that in the colonial days, they had a map that was projecting their claim as this land was the land of Virginia. This land
was...
That's
how they visualized it.
That's not how they visualized it. That's how the king and the colonies were claiming that, because they already knew that Portugal and Spain was, you know, was not coming into America, but they figured, okay, even though they're not coming in, we want to extend and make these claims now so that they will sink, think twice before they come across those lines. And the same thing with France. And so when we look at Georgia, I think, you know, there's actually a map that shows this extension. And the Ohio Valley, I'm trying to remember, is the Ohio Valley, was that a part of Virginia as well? I think it was a part of Virginia, because Pennsylvania was just a very small and very specific state that was etched out for this religious freedom, for the Quakers and all of that. And so the reason why certain states were formed, they were formed for very specific purposes, and the majority of the interest that the crown had was in the mercantile system, in growing its economy. I mean, at this point in time, London or England, Britain was becoming very rich, and because they were making money off of this mercantile system. Because they controlled the global economy.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, they were controlling even China by running opium into China and pulling tea out and exchanging opium that they were pulling out of Bangladesh or the Pakistan area, northern India, and they were shipping that into China and getting the Chinese addicted to opium and so forth. So anyway, they have been just sneaky, nefarious, undermining governments of the world, you know, all the way down this, from the point that they beat the Spanish Armada, they became this undermining, conniving government that has been manipulating the world down this path. And as a matter of fact, you know, the birth of communism, you know, where Marx and Engels were, when, you know, they finally, you know, planted themselves to flourish, at least Marx did, was in London.
I'm not sure I remember that.
Yeah, so Marx, you know, he actually he had a very well-to-do Englishman who brought him in and gave him some money to invest in the stock market, to teach Marx. This is after the Communist Manifesto. And so he, you know, taught Marx how to use the stock market to make a living. And Marx basically, you know, sustained himself off of capitalism.
So they used capitalism to fund absolutely communism.
So he wrote this book because it was a theoretical book. It was the call. So... Technically, when he wrote that book, I think it was like the 1840s. It was long before the Tsar had surrendered the serfs and slavery and emancipated them. That happened in the 1860s, like 20-some years later. That was what caused the problem, and where Marx's book became instrumental in creating a collectivism and this concept of communism in Russia, but actually Germany applied communism before Russia did. It was called socialism. But in France, before the book, they already had the guidebook, which was Plato. And Plato was statism, where the state would control everything, because that's what the Illuminati were trying to do.
Which and book was that? Was that Plato's Republic?
Yeah, Plato's Republic, correct.
Okay.
And so, and that's up on my website. So all of these books are out there. So I don't want to go down this huge history of the conspiracy, but bottom line, you know, this map of the United States was earmarked for the stretching of the kingdom of Britain to stripe across North America as a part of their commonwealth. That Canada was, a, you know, another part of their commonwealth. And as a matter of fact, you know, because they couldn't control everything, Canada kind of got away from them. Because if you really look, when the Americans, the British loyalists left America, most of them went where? Canada.
Okay.
And so what ended up happening? Well, the French got really upset and they severed themselves and they created a French quarter in, what is it, Montreal or Quebec?
Quebec.
Yeah. And so there you go. Because the French were up there already. And, you know, they thought, okay, well, we got this. Now, all of a sudden, the Yanks, they revolted, got away, and now they forced the Tories out. And so, and I know in my interview with McKibbins, he talks about that we, you know, paying the debt and all of that. That was not a part of the Constitution, even though there were obligations that we paid. I can find, there is no, zero checks or money that was sent to the crown. There may have been money that, you know, because we did borrow money from Holland. I don't know about British banks, but I know we owed banks money. France was one. And had we not paid France back, because we were very aggressive in paying France back as soon as we formed. Why? Because I think we that was our biggest debt that we had.
Well, you know, we made it a point in the Constitution to let the nations know that we were going to pay our debts back.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But more importantly, France was the number one, and the reason why this is Providence. Because in 1790, they had the revolution. And once they settled into their new power, Napoleon Bonaparte, if he looked and realized that America wasn't paying France that debt, oh, he would have came to America instead of focusing on going into Russia and all parts of the European area, right?
What you're saying is that we aggressively repaid France.
Yes, because they were such an ally.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, because of that, it opened the door for us to buy the Louisiana Territory.
Mm.
So, folks, I mean, things were being, you know, even though Britain thought that they had these controls, but the reality is, because go look it up, the Tories were kicked out and the British demanded, and if you read, if you read the Treaty of Versailles, the 1783 treaty, clearly we say that we're going to honor our debts. And
but, the Treaty of Versailles or the Treaty of Paris?
The Treaty of Paris. I'm sorry.
Okay.
You're right. I think it was in Versailles, but they called it the Treaty of Paris, right?
Okay.
So, because the Treaty of Versailles is really a very specific treaty for World War II.
Yeah, that's why I was...
Right. Okay. I think, I'm pretty sure Versailles is in the Paris area. I'm not sure. But I thought that that's where they assembled, at least at one of the points in time. And I think when the final draft was done, they called it the Treaty of Paris. But, you know, there was one point in time where they were working in England with Thomas Jefferson and John Jay and John Adams. And I forget there was another gentleman there. And that's when those two kind of left. Jefferson bowed out of the treaty process, and Adams stuck with it. And in Paris, they signed this off, and they were, you know, men of honor that, okay, we're going to pay our debt. And so the one thing that really tells me that we weren't paying the debt is, you know, as McGibbons kind of points out, that Hamilton instituted unconstitutionally these banks by using British backing, British bank backing. And had they, and I think had Congress known that, I think that that would have been an absolute, you know, raised to the level. I mean, the newspapers would have ran articles on that.
Right.
As a matter of fact, Thomas Jefferson becoming a Francophile and hating the Anglophiles in America, and most of the people were anti-Anglophiles. Go ahead.
Okay. Really?
Really? Is that a question? What?
Yeah, that was a question. I didn't realize that Jefferson was really that angry with the British. Well, yes, I did. Excuse me. He wrote the Declaration of Independence.
So, also, he was standing up in supporting France, and what ended up biting him on the backside was the fact that the French started cutting off everybody's heads. The revolution became bloody, and it became uncivil. And everybody in America looked at that and said, you can't look at France today and say that is not an abomination.
And that was completely unexpected.
Yes, it was. Absolutely. So this whole time, Thomas Jefferson and the Francophiles in America were saying the French are our friends and they're good people. They're better people than the Francophiles. Then, the results of the revolution, when they finally sought power and they chopped off Marie Antoinette's head and everything else, you know, they go, and so people, you know, kind of gasped and said, well, we don't want to emulate that kind of revolution here, because, you know, Thomas Jefferson was basically saying, hey, this is great. They're revolting. This is awesome. And then he had to backpedal that. But the bottom line was everybody still remembered what Britain was doing and why we revolted. And so there's no doubt that the members of Congress would not have, gone quietly into a dark room with Hamilton. There may have been a few players that were in the league with Hamilton. There may have been a few. But this would have broke, there's no doubt in my mind, if everybody knew. But as I said previously, it doesn't matter who came along. It could have been the King of England. You know, came to America and met. They could have pictures in a YouTube video of the King of England and Hamilton conspiring to create this national bank that would have been a violation of the Constitution. It doesn't matter who was behind it. The Constitution did not authorize the federal government to possess a bank.
Right.
So that's why I keep saying, and I don't mean to be dismissive of the history. It just doesn't matter. They didn't have the authority. That's what's important. And we got to get them back into exercising only those things they have the authority. That should be the dominant dialogue.
Do you think that it's still stuck in Britain's craw that America got away?
I don't think it is anymore. I think with a lot of Brits, because I've met a lot of Brits and Irish people that have come here, and some of them have basically, they're just inhabitants because they just refuse to become a citizen. I actually met a friend that was, his wife was really close friends with my wife, and we got to know, each other. And I don't think he ever became a citizen, and he refused to celebrate the 4th of July, and that type of thing, because he felt bad because we won. But, he didn't know the conspiracy, or he didn't know what was really happening underneath the tables of how they were exercising powers and granting powers to the federal government that didn't exist. Now we're going into break, so we'll be right back, folks, right after this promo. But the whole point of what we want to get back to, I want to get back to the counties and why they're important. See, that's what happens when you start talking about the conspiracy. It starts all of a sudden, rearing this control over what you really want to talk about. The fact is, we need to talk about where the power really lies. And so when we come back, we're going to talk about that, and Baker v. Carr will be back right after this. Thank you so much.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so this is what happens when we start talking about conspiracies, or I should say the underlying problem of how and why, you know, the Constitution was being violated. So we were an open country. We believed in liberty. We believed in everybody, allowing everybody to come here and partaking in this beautiful experiment. And many of the people, come to find out, there were very specific people that were sent here in doing the business of the crown. These were spies. And these spies co-opted other spies. No, I'm not sure when Hamilton became a spy. I don't even know if it's true based on the evidence that's been presented. I saw a paper that was found in Canada, and I don't care. It's nice, but I don't really care. I know Hamilton knew he was violating the Constitution. He was doing everything he could to actually puncture holes in the Constitution. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's irritating, but yes, of course it makes sense.
Okay, so this guy may have been coached or what have you, which kind of stands to reason why, you know, some of the stuff he was doing, maybe he did get help. I mean, I will say this, that if anybody that knows Hamilton, he was probably the second most literate man on this continent. He was very well read. He was a lifetime student, was constantly studying up until, you know, the Constitution and so forth. And he was still pushing boundaries and was coming up with academic arguments of, oh, why we can imply powers. But they weren't solid. They weren't grounded on the Constitution. They were grounded on theory. This is why when you look at what Hamilton was saying during the ratification debates, he was constantly going into theoretical politics.
But wasn't he playing a different tune during the Federalist Papers?
Oh, absolutely. So the Federalist Papers, he took a very hard stance. Why? Because as a lawyer, he knew that this was hyperbole. In other words, it has no legal standing. It's just an opinion. The only thing that had legal standing in a court of law regarding a contract or a compact and the terms and definitions that were being provided, the Federalist Papers were not legal terms and definitions. They were just insights of what these men said they were. It didn't have any impact on the ratification debates. What moved the dialogue in the ratification debates was the testimony between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. Maybe they used some of the Federalist Papers, but whatever they chose to use is what they thought would actually help people understand why this Constitution was a better way of governing, and everybody agreed. And based on those premises, that's what matters. Had it been disclosed, oh, that we're going to be able to do these things, then they had it been disclosed that there would be implied powers that the federal government could actually easily operate outside the boundaries of the. It was constantly stated. That's why Madison, in his letter to John G. Jackson, said, look, it was constantly justified on these very limited enumerations, period. He even said that in the note or in his reports on the Virginia resolutions, as well as the notes on nullification. He kept on saying the same thing. The Constitution was sold on this very limited government.
Right. But this, apparently, this guy that Jefferson Madison considered the creature was a very different creature between the Federalist Papers and the ratification debates. And no, and that wasn't, that's not been noticed. I don't know that anyone else has pointed out that out besides you.
No, so there are other people. Believe me, there are other people. I know Douglas V. Gibbs and a lot of other people that have pointed to how Hamilton has really gone out of his way to undermine the Constitution and argued for undermining the Constitution.
Yeah.
That all being said,
mm-hmm.
back to the state. So it doesn't matter what has happened and how they've justified it. What matters is this: the state stand up and say, look, here's the ratification debate. Show me that this was discussed or delegated. If not, it's up to us to determine whether you can do it or not.
Right.
If you don't understand what that line means, the judiciary does not have the authority to interpret and define it. They have to come to us.
Mm-hmm.
The only way anything, and I just emphasize this, just consider me speaking at a decibel that hurts your ears, folks. The only way anything can become rooted constitutional is it must come from the states. Because it is their compact. It is not the court's compact. So the fact, we've been bamboozled by lawyers in the bar system to say, oh, well, we have this latitude to, if we can't figure it out, we can start interpreting. No. Had that been proposed to the people in the ratification debates, they would have rejected this Constitution that fast. And that was,
well, there's something else.
Go ahead.
There's something else you mentioned that we ought to point out, because oftentimes people say, I've heard it said that we the people means the people themselves. But originally, and this was changed by the Style Committee.
Yes.
Isn't it correct? Originally it said we the people of, and it listed each state.
Yes, 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 yes.
So the emphasis of
the sovereign state of Georgia, the sovereign state of, it was very, it was a whole page.
Sure. And so it was specific that they were the state. So people see, people read we the people and they will miss that because they don't know what the original intent.
It lends to the concept of democracy. Correct. And this is why our educational institution is obviating the real reality that it is not a democracy, that we the people really doesn't stand for a democracy. It stands for the people forming government, and the only government, this goes back to our counties, the mm-hmm. only government that we the people absolutely institute is our counties.
Right.
This goes back to the Declaration. This goes back to what we really need to be talking about. So if you really understand, the most important representation you have is the one that you can actually drive down on a given day because it's closest to you.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get in the grill of your representative and say, how are you allowing this to happen? You mm-hmm. take an oath to this Constitution to support and defend it. Why is it that you're doing nothing regarding all of these atrocities? Well, what do you want me to do? It's the state's job. And this is where petitions come in. Now, let me talk about the Baker v. Carr, Reynolds v. Sims.
Okay.
So there were two cases, and I think Baker v. Carr is a case that really reaches back to, you know, a very old election problem that was brought forward because somebody complained that they didn't have, their vote was not equal to the people in a county. And see, what ended up happening, there may have been 5,000 people in a county, and because they were guaranteed representation, then they felt that that vote in their representative outweighed the power of their vote in the city where they were apportioned by 20,000 because they were limiting their legislature based on seats.
Okay.
And so so here's the thing. This came into a federal court that this guy complained and said, hey, I don't have equal representation, and we have a right to not just, you know, have equal voice and equal suffrage, but equal representation.
But where did he get that from?
It's not in the Constitution. It is a principle of democracy. So this lawsuit created a new principle that basically was given birth by the Warren Court. One person, one vote. In other words, it created an equality. It basically moved us into a concept of a democracy instead of people of sovereign governments that have come together and created a union at a state level in creating their state. Technically, we have a union in every state. When you have counties that have come together and created a constitution, these state constitutions were created not by we the people. They didn't send, when they formed that state, they didn't send all the able-bodied people into this town.
Into an auditorium.
I mean, back in those days, they had to do it out in town. So it must have been a big, huge bonfire at night, right?
Right.
No, that's not what happened. The counties sent delegates in a representative government to represent them from these counties in forming a state. And in essence, they did the exact same thing the states did in forming the federal government or the general government. They sent delegates from the states, right? And when they ratified it, each county, you know, piped in and they voted as counties. And if you don't believe me, go look at the back end of the ratification debates. They count the votes by county.
Right.
And absolutely. And technically, if you go through each of the ratification, I haven't proven this, but I believe there was a majority of counties that ratified the Constitution. It wasn't just a majority of votes. Does that make sense?
Correct. Well, I remember several of them where I noticed they voted by county in a majority of counties.
Yes.
I don't know. I don't remember all of them. And I think a couple of them, you just had like Rhode Island just rubber stamped it.
Yeah. Many of them just unanimously accepted it. Right.
Right.
Which means it was unanimous.
Right. Okay. Sure. Okay. But in many of them, you know, there was actually a vote recorded by county.
Yes. And so there were six states where it was ratified. Seven states almost unanimous. I mean, it was unanimous with seven states.
Mm-hmm.
Seven states unanimously accepted the Constitution. Six states vigorously debated it, but you'll still find that it was a majority in each of the states. I'm taking a leap of faith here that, you know, and if you prove me wrong, okay, they still considered it ratified, but my point is that if it still crossed the threshold in every county, that each county ratified this.
Right.
And there had to have been at least a majority of the counties that ratified it, which is how I'm saying that there's no way that the majority of the counties could have not ratified it and it still got ratified.
Correct.
Okay. And so that's why I'm taking this leap of faith. I think numerically, the odds are really, you know, it's a very, very low percentage that the majority of the counties rejected the Constitution, but it still ratified it by a majority of votes.
Correct.
So my point is that when we look at how Madison spelt out the argument of interposition, how the states have that authority, that same power in these constitutions is the same at the county level.
But, you know, I think that that would be interesting. I think it would almost be compelling to county commissioners.
It would be. And as a matter of fact, some of the county commissioners are starting to wake up. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. This is why we focus. And actually, folks, I want you to look at it this way. It's not about trying to burn and you know, singe, you know, and scorch our county commissioners. If you have good county commissioners, I think it won't take long. As a matter of fact, watch those two videos I did in discussing with these county commissioners in Washington State exactly, you know, what they need to do and why we're doing this. There's two more videos that need to come out, but I'm taking a friendly approach. So we had a group go into their county commissioners with petitions that we have, and they went in with a scorched earth, you know, singeing and hate and visceral, and they got nowhere. And as a matter of fact, it emboldened these progressives on the county to say, see, we can shut these guys down.
Yeah, okay.
Because they didn't take the time to get a movement of people to get engaged. We have to get people. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, you're right. One, you got to get a movement of people to get engaged. And I think it doesn't hurt to have a relationship with the commissioners. You know, sometimes I go to commissioners meetings. You did your video with the commissioners and they listened to you.
And nine times out of 10, they're going to sit down, make an appointment to go in there and say, hey, even if you don't know what to say, just say, hey, can I come in? I want to show a video of instruction to you and then play my video.
Sure.
I don't get paid. If you download it and you go to all the counties in your state, I'm not getting paid by that. I'm just saying, if you can't say the words, then let me say the words for you. But we have to start the dialogue. And I honestly believe this is why I made the approach to say, look, we all have blood on our hands. And those of us, we the people, we have the most because we have the responsibility of holding our public servants accountable. We have the right of petition to petition them for the redress of grievances. And if we don't do it, then who do we blame when they're not abiding by their oath? Mm-hmm. Is it their fault? No, they're getting away with it because we're not calling them out.
Right.
You know, do you let your kids get away with stuff? Yeah, of course you do, because I see them out in the streets. Mm-hmm. I see parents go to parent-teacher conferences and say, you better not touch my kid. When that kid deserved a good butt whooping.
My brother told me that he hated parent-teacher conferences because every time he came home, he got spanked. Okay? so
that's because he deserved it.
Yeah.
I hate to be quick to judge your brother like that, but I'm telling you, parents love you. And the only reason they spank you and correct you is because they love you.
Well, not only that, they want you to turn out. There's a concept called pay now or pay later. A spanking is nothing compared to what could happen to you if you violate the laws as an adult. If you don't have the honor to be self-governing as an adult. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, this is where I talk about the choice of pain you're going to feel. You know, you either suffer the pain of discipline, or you suffer the pain of regret. Because bottom line, you know, we're all going to go through this choice process, and if you fail, who do you blame? When we look at how we see parents behave, I'll give you a good case in point, too. Michael Brown, or who's the young man that was shot by the Hispanic gentleman?
Is this recent?
No. We're talking about during the Obama administration, where Obama basically said... Trayvon or whatever this kid's name was.
Trayvon Martin.
Yeah, okay. There you go. And Michael Brown. There's two cases right there. And how did the parents behave? They were defending the bad behavior of their children. Now, I could see if Michael Brown was, you know, singing a choir, you know, or, you know, practicing a choir song of praising the Lord on the sidewalk, just minding his own business, when a police came and actually started, you know, hey, shut up, and started harassing him to where, you know, he ended up dying by the brutality of a policeman. But that wasn't the case. It wasn't the case at all. He didn't walk out of a church choir. He was just committing a crime, and he was trying to get away with it. And the same thing, I mean, parents should actually, you know, feel sorry that, you know, their children have made these choices instead of, you know, well, we have an opportunity to try to make money off the police department because, well, maybe this was excessive. Well, I think in Michael Brown's case, when he, you know, tried to get a hold of that gun, it became an academic struggle of, you know, life and death. And I think that was the same thing with George Zimmerman. You know, he wasn't a policeman, but, you know, they were fighting over that gun. As a matter of fact, George Zimmerman, you know, he was, I believe Trayvon ran him down as he started running away because I think he realized that he wasn't, you know, in the mood of, you know, using that kind of force. And so as we look at the behavior, I'm going, how can these parents take these positions? Help me out. And it's not, this is not just a cultural thing. This is an American thing. I see every creed, every ethnicity, every form, mothers, fathers, it doesn't matter. They're out there defending bad behavior of their children instead of saying, you know what, I did everything I can to, you know, to teach my children to walk in the ways of the Lord. And I, you know, that I just can't get through to them, because that happens. We would all empathize and understand. Yeah, that happens. But yeah, to actually try to turn the tables for monetary gain is, that's an indictment right there, isn't it? So my my point is that, you know, we actually have to start changing our paradigms. We actually have to start realizing that our community and our county is the focus of where we have to start holding public servants accountable. And so we can get into how to do all of this. And as a matter of fact, I'll probably talk about that next week. But tomorrow is, you know, actually today is the winter solstice. Is it solstice?
Yes. No, yes. It's the winter.
Yeah, it's the winter wilding. And so,
right,
in other words, tomorrow I'm actually going to talk about the winter wilding that actually swept, you know, Europe and North America, or America specifically, and created such havoc on the civility of, I'll just say, civilized people. I mean, people just got drunk and crazy. And we'll talk about how this winter pagan holiday became this religious, supposedly this religious holiday. And it has been completely co-opted by corporations, and it's all about their bottom line.
Okay, this is tomorrow's show.
This is tomorrow's show. So today I'm just kind of helping everybody prepare what I'm going to dive into, because this is my annual. I'm kicking Santa, but I'm elevating Christ.
Okay.
Because I'm okay with taking a day. As a matter of fact, I think we ought to find a day every month to, you know, to elevate Christ and what he may have done, you know, in sure, that particular month, because he did so much.
Well, typically we've got, you know, at least 4 or 5 days, depending on how many Sabbaths there are in a month, right?
Oh, absolutely. I get that. I get that. But no, look at how the whole world kind of comes together. I mean, we have historical records of World War I and other, you know, wars and battles where on Christmas Eve night or what have you, they paused the war. They paused the fighting for this peace on Earth.
I've heard that.
Yeah, and it's powerful stuff when we understand, you know, the source of this is in recognizing him. It's not about putting a bunch of materialistic things around really colorful paper underneath a pagan tree.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to dive into that. I'm going to dive into that tomorrow. And I hope everybody enjoys this, because it's to my job isn't to just say everything we're doing is fine, you know, all's well. You know, that guy, I forget, there's a movie or something where this guy kept always says there's all's well when everything's just falling apart.
I don't remember what it is, but yeah.
I'm not that guy. I'm challenging everybody to start recognizing what the heck's going on and why are we doing these things. And next week, I will probably on Thursday and Friday go into how to set effective goals. Because what are we doing? We're walking into the new year, and I want people to hear, you know, a good way of how they can, if you really want to make changes, you really want to, you know, make this coming year a big difference in your life, in the direction of your family, a direction of this country, then set some effective goals and how to set them and obtain them. So that's what I will do on probably either Thursday and Friday or just Friday. But I think these types of messages help people, because nobody ever, you know, goes through how do I set effective goals. So,
okay.
And so that's what we're going to be doing. So for 2 minutes left, this is why when you look at the petitions, and this has become, I think, the coup d'etat, or this is, you know, this I really think has you put all of the focus by setting expectations, the very last part of the petitions, because you saw this and you incorporated it in your petition that we're putting out really soon regarding the purchase
Missouri
of
land.
Yeah, Missouri lands or state land, being
sure.
able to buy state land. And so foreigners being able to buy state land. And so you want to talk a little bit about how that works as far as the expectations. We got 1 minute.
Okay, well, I can tell you what's happening, and there's a big thing in Missouri about foreign ownership of productive farmland, because the foreign owners abuse the process, they abuse the tax structure, and they're actually hiring people that aren't Americans. In fact, they're hiring invaders. So that's a big problem, and so we're addressing that with this petition, and to county commissioners, and pointing out this is one of those places where we point out that the Constitution does not allow for the foreign ownership of land.
Right. But specifically in the petition, the last five pages, folks, what we do, and I'll just ask you to go read the petition number 9 on our petition page on reclaimingtherepublic.org. Go there and just look at the last 6 pages, because what we do is we call out the county, and the county needs to do this, to tell every other county to do this. Then they tell the state what they need to do. And there's all of these very specific steps that if your county commissioners follow this, it will force the dialogue of addressing this egregious problem.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Paul, for joining us.
All right.
So with that, folks... We will be back tomorrow to do the Christmas special. I'm going to give you the history of Christmas, and I'm going to give you a pragmatic look at, you know, really the truth of how this righteous holiday had been co-opted and how we've been manipulated. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.